Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't
like the mystery.
Yeah, we're basically we're up to chapter 13, Perek Yud Gimel. I know that people are probably very concerned as to who the new leader of the United States government is. That's indeed very, very fascinating, but again, we focus also not only on the present, but we focus back on the eternal past of the Jewish people and the lessons that it does teach us. Basically, if you remember, Perek Yud Bet is simply a summary enumeration of the various Canaanite kings that Yehoshua had conquered, and if you add them up, they add up to 31, and that is why in Chazal there is a constant reference to the Lamed Aleph Melachim, the 31 kings that Yehoshua conquered. It is equally true, however, as the next parak explicitly declares, that there were large portions of the land of Israel that was not brought under the dominion of Yehoshua. And in Perek Yud Gimel, it actually enumerates the portions of the lands that had not yet been conquered. In particular, this is the, well, actually the Gaza Strip, so again, indeed, it's a foreshadowing of the present conflict, but particularly along the Mediterranean coast in the south, that was land that continued to be occupied by the Philistines. And thus we find in the book of Samuel and the like that there was a constant skirmish. Even in the book of Judges, Shimshon and the like were always fighting with the Philistines. Well, the Philistines were concentrated in five cities, five coastal cities. Among them were Aza, which of course is Gaza. Right, you know that the reason why the ayin always turns into a G is because of the Greek alphabet. That's right, Sodom and Gomorrah is Amora. Because the ayin, the consonant ayin in Greek, which the New Testament in Greek is turns into a G. That's why, so it's not Sodom and Talmud or something, Gomorrah, right? That's okay. Yeah. So the cities are Aza, Gaza, Ashkelon. Yeah, what did I find? It mentions Ashdod, Ekron. Okay, those are the main Philistine cities, and they are along the Mediterranean coast. There were also areas up north that had not yet been conquered. So it is important to recognize that although the various conquests of Yehoshua did take place over a seven-year period, this is Chazal's understanding. Remember how they figured out, just to remind people, the Pasuk does not say it took 7 years, but we figure it out from the fact that Kalev says he is 85 years old, and he was 40 years old at the time of the spies, and they wandered in the desert 38 years after that, because the 2 years preceded the spies. So 40 and 38 is 78, and if he's 85 when Yehoshua finishes his conquest, that means 7 years of conquest. So it took 7 years, but nevertheless, there was much that remained to be conquered. In particular, we will see, Yerushalayim itself was not yet conquered. And Yerushalayim, we know, was not finally conquered until the reign of David HaMelech, which is even after the, which is really hundreds of years later, over 300 years later. So the job was not complete. But what's interesting is, if you look at chapter 13, the Pasuk begins, the Yehoshua Zakein Ba Bayamim. Yehoshua was already old. He was advanced in years. Vayomer Hashem Elav. And Hashem says to him, Ataza Kanta Batza Bayamim. You have now aged and you're advanced in years. And yet, the Ha'aretz Nishara Harbei Miod Lerishta. There is much of the land that remains to be inherited. It seems to be, although it's not clear, that there's a certain note of criticism in the way God seems to be speaking, meaning, you're an old man, you haven't done the job yet. And then we're given the boundaries of Zot Ha'aretz HaNisharet. As I say, primarily there are two major strips. There is the a large portion of the southern coastal plain, and then there is a northern boundary around the modern Lebanese border, and then, of course, there is the city of Yerushalayim itself, which has not yet been taken care of. But if you look at verse 7, God gives Yehoshua a very interesting command, and that is, V'yata chalek es et haaretz hazot b'nachala l'titash et vakim. In other words, what he's saying is, even though the total land has not been conquered, it is time to allocate portions to the tribes. This is called Kabbalah. Now, that means in effect, we'll have many, many prakim, or several prakim, that talk about the tribal boundaries. But you understand what that means? That means it's quite possible in Yeshua's lifetime that tribes were assigned a portion that had not yet been conquered. Meaning, your land remains to be conquered. So, where do they live in the interim is a good question, but I guess, of course, where did anybody live in the interim? Obviously, they did not have set assigned portions. But the concept was, and this is an interesting idea, that it was not only the conquest of Eretz Yisrael that was directed by divine commands, but also the division of Eretz Yisrael was determined by divine command. And I'll discuss the process in some detail. Meaning, God didn't just say, you know, wherever you settle is where you live, but rather the Jewish nation conquers the territory, but then there is a mechanism that determines, number one, not only where the tribes have their boundaries, but we will see, it's much more specific. Every single individual was allocated a particular portion in the land of Israel. And this surveying and distribution process actually took 7 years as well, although there's no clear makar, there's no clear source in the Pesukim for this, but Chazal say, just as Kibush took 7 years, Chalukah took 7 years. Now obviously when we say Chalukah took 7 years, we don't mean it took 7 years to determine the tribal boundaries, that wouldn't take that long, but to kind of divide it based on each individual. Now, here is the issue I wanted to say. I want to discuss this. This is a bit of a technical issue. But we have a series of chapters in which the boundaries of each tribe are given. And you can look at a map. The truth of the matter is all of these boundaries are very imprecise because we can't identify with exactness where all of these ancient cities are. And of course, as anyone who is familiar with biblical archaeology knows, the mere fact that a given place name is the same as a name, that doesn't mean it's the same place at all. Even in the Haggadah, for example. Remember in the Haggadah, there's a famous Seder in Bnei Brak, Rabbi Akiva. Mm-hmm. And obviously it's not modern Bnei Brak, because modern Bnei Brak was not founded until around 1920. So it's a totally different city. Yericho, according to rabbinic tradition, is not ancient Yericho, because that is not supposed to be rebuilt, right? It's another nearby city. So the truth is, where these boundaries are a matter of conjecture. We do know approximately, of course, that Yehudah was in the south, up to Yerushalayim. And we know that Yisachar and Zebulun were up north, around the Sea of Galilee, right? So we know basically where they were. But here is the question. The Pasuk says over and over again that the portions of the land were allocated by Golgal. That means a lottery. Meaning to say that the land was divvied up into territories, and then there was a lottery. Meaning, how do you do a lottery? You put 12 pieces of paper, or whatever it is, that mark zone 1, zone 2, zone 3, and you have 12 tribes, and you match the zone with the tribe. This is called a Goral. Who were the people who did the Goral? It was Yehoshua. And the Nisim, the heads of the tribes, were this, again, they were like the election judges, just like when you canvass votes, you have to have a Democrat and a Republican to be sure that nobody is miscounting. So too, to be sure that the lottery was not manipulated, all the tribal representatives had to be there to ensure the fairness of the lottery. But here is the question. The question is this. What sense does a lottery make, given the fact that each tribe had a different population? There were big tribes and there were small tribes. And you have these different zones, and, well, either way, if the zones were the same size, which the maps do not so indicate, but if we assume the zones were the same size, then I guess a lottery could work, although it would seem to be unfair to big tribes. But at least it would work in the sense, because whether a tribe gets a zone 1 or a zone 2 makes no difference because they're the same size. If, on the other hand, the zones were different sizes, that only makes sense after the fact, meaning to say it makes sense that a big tribe gets a big zone, but when you do it via lottery, how do you know the big tribe is going to get the big zone? Maybe the small tribe will get the big zone, and the big tribe will get the small zone. So in other words, how does a lottery work when you have populations or tribes that are of a different size? So there are really two basic approaches. Again, in the Talmud, there's a lot of discussion about this. It is a very complicated area, actually. But there are two basic approaches. Nachmanides' approach, Ramban, which is not reflected in the maps, that's why I think if you look at the map, you're not going to see it this way, is that Eretz Yisrael was divided into 12 zones of equal size. Equal size. And that does mean indeed, that per capita, per person, members of large tribes received less land per family. Because if you have the same amount of land, and you have to divide it among larger numbers of people, each person is going to get less land than if you have a smaller tribe dividing the land. And therefore, Ramban says, I'll discuss how it was divided among individuals. That also is very fascinating. But at least the initial tribal allocation that is described here, we divide the land into 12 regions, and then we have a lottery matchup. And in that way, you don't have the paradox of a larger tribe getting a smaller aggregate portion. Everyone got the same portion of land, and then it's subdivided. Yeah.
Isn't that necessarily paradoxical?
Yeah.
You have to take into consideration the quantity, the power.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yes, that is very true. That is very true. On the other hand, you are dealing with, well, yes, value of land could obviously 1 acre of very valuable land could override 10 acres of less valuable land. But still, if you're dealing with a lottery system, you still have the same problem, because in a lottery system, if you're allocating to a large tribe the same amount of land as you're allocating to a small tribe, maybe the lottery will give to the large tribe the same amount of land that's less valuable. In other words, you haven't avoided the paradox, unless we assume that because the lottery system is obviously divinely inspired, that God is going to work it out so you'll get the right answer. I mean, that would have to be your underlying assumption. But this is the Ramban's opinion. The Ramban's opinion, which, as I say, is not reflected in the maps, is that the tribal division of the land of Israel proceeded, actually I shouldn't say 12 portions, because we have to qualify that. Really, it's only 9.5 portions. The reason is because the 2.5 tribes, Reuven, Gad, and Chatzi Shevet Menasheh, half of that already took their portions east of the Jordan River, and the tribe of Levi
did not get
a portion at all. What they were given is 48 cities that were scattered throughout the land of Israel. And remember, I think we made the point last week that there's a positive way of looking at that, and there's also a negative way of looking at that. In other words, the positive way is, since the tribe of Levi were the spiritual leaders of the Jewish people, so God wanted them to have an influence in every part of Klal Yisrael, that every community, as it were, should have their spiritual leaders. The negative way of looking at it is that Yaakov cursed Shimon and Levi by saying that I want them to be scattered, because when they're together, their anger and their fury and their violence is very destructive. And therefore, Levi was scattered, because in spite of the fact that they were spiritual leaders, they were prone to perhaps being too zealous and the like. And in fact, so number one, Reuven and Gad and Chatzi Shevet Menasheh were the east. Shevet Levi had 48 cities scattered throughout Eretz Yisrael. And I should mention, Shimon himself, the tribe of Shimon, similarly did not have a concrete territory. Shimon consisted of a lot of cities interspersed within Yehuda. So when it comes to that, therefore, we eliminate Reuven and Gad, Chatzi Shevet Menasheh, but we eliminate Shevet Levi. We fundamentally eliminate the tribe of Shimon, although Shimon had cities, but Shimon's cities were Muvla in Yehuda. However, for purposes of this count, we count the tribe of Yosef, so to speak, as two tribes, Ephraim and half of Manasseh, and they had adjacent but distinct portions in the land of Israel. But be it as it may, the Ramban says, if we exclude Transjordan, if we exclude the east bank of the Jordan, Eretz Yisrael was divided into equal portions, which were then assigned by lottery. That is one view. The Abarbanel takes a different view. The Abarbanel questions this basically with the argument that it's unfair in terms of territory that large tribes should get proportionally less land than small tribes. So he suggests that the boundaries were not fixed till after the lottery allocated the portions, meaning to say that the zones were geographical zones, but they were not given precise contours. So, for example, we talked about the northern coastal region, the southern coastal region, the Negev, but the exact parameters of the boundary was not determined or adjusted till after the lottery determined the allocation. So, for example, let's take Yehuda. Yehuda is in the south, from Yerushalayim southward. The precise, although we are given the precise delineation of boundaries in the book of Yehoshua, but the Abarbanel says it's a bit misleading. Those boundaries were not defined in the lottery itself. The lottery simply allocated to the tribe the geographical approximate region. So if a small tribe got it, we would shrink it. If a large tribe got it, we would expand it. And therefore the Abarbanel says that the boundaries were not fixed till after the lottery allocated the zone. So we have two basic approaches in the Rishonim, whether we are dealing with an exact equal division of the lands, which would mean larger tribes proportionally got less, or whether the boundaries themselves were not determined until after the allocation. The third approach we will call more of the supernatural approach, in which the final boundaries were determined, which could have resulted in the paradox of a small tribe getting a huge amount of land, but since we knew that the Goral was determined by God, the right answer would come up. But in a way, that never made sense to me, because if you know ahead of time when you make up the boundaries that where it's going to go, like, why are you doing the lottery? I mean, like, you're doing something knowing the answer ahead of time. And some say, indeed, the lottery was simply to show the people. In other words, Yeshua already knew by divine command who would get what, but he wanted the lottery to confirm his results, to show kind of in a miraculous way that God is confirming him. So in that sense, the lottery was a confirmation of what was already told to Yehoshua and the like. Right, so these are three interpretations of the tribal units. And as I say, if you look at a map, you clearly see that, although there's a lot of uncertainty, but everybody who makes maps does presuppose that the size of the territory varied with the tribes, that there was not a uniform division of the land, unlike Ramban. Also, we do see in the narrative a very interesting thing, that apparently there was land that was regarded as no man's land that was unassigned. Because there's an incident, well, we'll get into this in more detail, where the tribe of Ephraim and Manasseh complained that we didn't get enough land for our people. And Yehoshua basically said, well, go and clear that forest, kind of expand yourself and you can take it over. And it's not clear, how could you expand your territory if you're going into another tribe? Apparently, there may have been a notion that certain portions were left open and tribes were given permission. Of course, they had to get national permission to kind of expand into adjacent territory, meaning the chalukah did not cover every inch. But we will see there might be other interpretations for that story. Yeah.
Do the cities of refuge come into these definitions at all?
Yes, very much so. Just to clarify the issue of the cities of refuge, right? The Yer Miklat, we know, is of course cities in which a person who killed inadvertently could seek protection from the Goel Hadam, the blood avenger, who would be permitted to kill him. And he goes to the city of refuge, and the city of refuge have a double function that you have to recognize. The city of refuge, on one hand, is a city of protection that the Goel Adam cannot enter. Of course, if he does enter with a weapon, he'll be killed for it. In other words, nothing is 100% safe, but the point is that the Goel Adam loses his legal right to kill the Rotzayah. So in that sense, the Yer Miklat is a protective device for the inadvertent. But we also have to understand that it's also a punishment. It is considered to be a form of house arrest. Because let's say the Rotzeach's position is, I don't want to go to the Yer Miklat, I'll get my own security, thank you. I'll be in my Miami home, and I will surround myself with a wire fence, an electric fence. He can't do that. In other words, It is not just for his benefit. It is also a form of arrest and penance. Now, the Ir Miklat, there were, there were six Ir Miklat. Three of them were in the territories of Reuven, Gad, and Chashan Manasseh, east of the Yarden. And three of them were in Eretz Yisrael proper. Now, all of the Ir Miklats are the cities of the Levium. So of the 48 cities, so consequently, of the 48 cities given to the Levium, six of them were designated as Arei Miklat. By the way, the Gemara makes the interesting point. Gee, how come you have three cities of refuge on the east bank of the Jordan when you only have 2.5 tribes living?
Yeah.
And then you have only three Arei Miklats on the west part of Eretz Israel, in which you have 9.5 tribes living. And the Gemara says that the truth is that in Gilad, in Eber HaYarden, there was much more murder going on. Much more murder, much more violence, and consequently a greater need for the Ir Miklat. But there's a question on that. Wait a second here. But the Ir Miklat is only for unintentional, accidental homicide. Just because there's a higher murder rate, but those are the people who will not be able to go to the Ir Miklat. So there are two short answers. One answer is, yeah, but plenty of people may go to the Ir Miklat with fraudulent claims, meaning you kill somebody and you want to get refuge, so, yeah, right? That's one reason. But there's another reason I think is a very profound reason. And that is, in a society where life itself is debased, then more accidental homicides are going to happen as well. Because a lot of accidents happen because of carelessness, negligence, people don't pay attention. But you see, there's a trickle-down effect. When life is cheap, then, you know, we pay... That's correct. We pay less attention. So the Gemara is making the point that if there's more murder and violence in society, it's going to affect even good, law-abiding people, that they're not going to look where they're going that much. You know, when they think they see a deer and they shoot, they're not going to be sure it's not a person. You see? So there is that idea. In other words, essentially, we become affected and corroded and degraded by the perversity of a society, even if we are not directly participating in the perversity to that extent. But there's a trickle-down effect. We do become, you know, you read about people's death and it does not affect you in the same way. You know, so that's an issue. Yeah?
I have a trick question. Why was Jericho forbidden to be rebuilt?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, basically, it was considered to be it was supposed to be a permanent monument of the great miracle that God did, that people should walk by the site of Jericho and always remember that the walls...
It should have been rebuilt.
No, because if you rebuild it, basically, that undoes the whole miracle was the walls fell down. You rebuild it, people walk by, you know, you can put a plaque on there or something. But,
and then you said that the Levites, who were the teachers of Israel,
yes.
What did they do there? What did they have
there? Well, keep in mind, you know, a Levi is not supposed to own land other than the cities, but they could have businesses, they could do tourist trade, they could do all sorts of things. But primarily, keep in mind that the Torah envisions Leviim and Kohanim as primarily people who were supported by the community, right? They would give them trumot is for the Kohen, tithes and the maaser, and the Leviim were supposed to be primarily involved in the teaching of Torah. They were the Torah teachers.
But when you said they had 48, what did they have there?
No, these were cities, homes.
They had property? Did they have...
They had property within these cities. In other words, it's as if... in other words, their cities were given to them. So within those cities, they did have property, but...
I thought they should have no nachala.
Well, the basic idea was that they didn't have they didn't have a separate area of land that was under the total control of Levi. They were under the tribal governments of whatever tribe they were located in. They were located in Yehuda, so they were under Yehuda's rule. But obviously, they did have within their cities of Leviim, they did have ownership of lands. Yeah.
After the size of the allocation,
right.
If there was some specialization, then there might be barter exchanges among the tribes. Have some equality per capita.
Well, again, that's an interesting question. I mean, you look at the maps and you look at the story here, so each tribe had its allocation. Now, what about immigration? What about, for example, if somebody from Yehuda wanted to be a fisherman, so he would relocate. Obviously, in the course of time, these tribal boundaries were not exclusive. In the course of time, you did have people migrating from one area to another area. Such migrations are described very, very commonly. However, keep in mind that because of rules such as the Jubilee, let's assume, for example, somebody from one tribe purchased land in another tribe, and he could even make his residence there. But because of the Jubilee year, it would eventually revert to the original owners. Meaning, part of the idea of Yovel is to maintain the integrity of these territorial boundaries. So even if people did trade, but still, the Yovel would cause it to go back. And that's why Yovel really lapsed when the tribal boundaries lapsed. And the destruction of the First Temple, the Yovel did not get reinstituted. And in fact, during the Second Temple period, there was absolutely no indication anymore that when the Jews came back to Eretz Israel, that they followed tribal boundaries. In other words, the institution of the tribal boundaries, it's not entirely clear why it lapsed. I mean, why didn't they do it again? But it's very, very clear from Tanakh and from Chazal that the notion that a certain tribe lived in a certain area, that totally terminated the construction of the First Temple and was never reinstituted. I should point out that in the book of Yechezkel, the prophet Ezekiel, and Yechezkel is the great specific prophet about what the future temple will look like and the like, he also gives us a division of the land of Israel, which has totally different boundaries than Joshua's. And there's apparently, there will once again be a tribal division, Liatid Lavo, which does not at all correspond. Actually, it's a much simpler division. It's almost a geometrical division of 13, including Levi, by the way, which will get a share in the land, 13 horizontal strips. You basically have, it's very, very simple compared to the maps that you see. You simply have the land of Israel going from north to south, greatly expanded, going all the way to the Euphrates River. And then you have these strips going east-west, 13 strips. And in the middle, where Yerushalayim is, you have the Kohanim and the Levi'im, which will have a share of the land. Right, so it's a totally different division, and you know, one could, if one had the time, one could actually compare, try to get some type of inner significance as to the geographical placement of the tribes in Yoshua's time, and why that placement will change in Yechezkel. It's interesting, of all the prophets, you know, you take a prophet like Yeshayahu, who also has magnificent prophecies of comfort, but they tend to be very poetic, very majestic, and not entirely specific. Then you take Yechezkel, who is also a prophet somewhat of comfort, but he really gets down to blueprints. He gets down to specifications and how many amot will this be and that be, and it really gives us a totally, it's very, very difficult to figure out because it's very hard, as you know, one of the hardest things, even in English, is to describe a building in words. Without pictures, it's very, very difficult. But he tries to create a verbal picture. And it's been posited that Yechezkel was a Kohen. And we know that. And as a Kohen, he had a much more detailed interest in the temple and the physical structure of the Avodah than perhaps the other prophets in general. And that's why he gets down to nuts and bolts. So it's very interesting to see the different style between the magnificent poetry of Isaiah and the very nuts and bolts description of Geulah that we find in the book of Yechezkel. But one of the very interesting things in Yechezkel is that he has a tribal division, the Atid Lavo, that is absolutely, totally different than the tribal division in the time of Yehoshua, which I think raises halachic problems. And I'll tell you why it raises halachic problems. Because when the Third Temple is reinstituted, Yovel is supposed to come back. Now the Jubilee year is the halacha that says land reverts to its ancestral owners. But that's not going to be true. There seems to be an inconsistency here because the ancestral owners are those who could claim title based on what Yehoshua gave them. But according to Yechezkel's division, they're going to be moved somewhere else. So how can both propositions be true? How can you say, on one hand, they seem to be contradictory. On one hand, the Yovel will be reinstituted. On the other hand, there'll be a different tribal division for the land of Israel. That seems to be a contradiction which I have not seen a resolution for. Yeah.
Is it the Temple Mount stays in Yehuda?
Yes, the temple is very interesting actually.
So Yehuda, that strip.
Yes, yes, that strip, yes. But I just want to say one thing about the Beit HaMikdash. The Beit HaMikdash itself, which, remember, was not even acquired as a site until David HaMelech's time. And by the way, the Temple Mount was not acquired by conquest. David conquered Yerushalayim, indeed. The Temple Mount was purchased. That itself is a very, very interesting lesson. Why was the Temple Mount? From Aravna, person Aravna Hayavusi. That's what it says. David bought the Temple Mount from him. And that, I think, is a very interesting idea, which may have some relevance for today. That is, just as David HaMelech could not build the Beit HaMikdash because he was a man of blood, although justifiable, God does not condemn David for waging his wars. But he just said, the temple is for Shalom. So too, the very acquisition of the Temple Mount could not be through conquest. It had to be through, dare I say it, negotiation. Now, because David had to negotiate a deal. What implication that has, I'm not entirely sure. I think it may almost lead to a direction that I would prefer not to go. But it does indicate that there's something special about the site of the temple not being conquered, but being purchased, negotiated, worked out. Because that is the idea of the Beit HaMikdash being a place of shalom. As you know, this is why David could not build the Beit HaMikdash, etc. But be it as it may, I want to make a point about tribal. So the point is, in whose section was the Beit HaMikdash located? So the truth of the matter is, it straddles. The Beit HaMikdash was exactly on the boundary between Yehuda and Binyamin. In other words, if you drew the tribal boundaries, it would cut right through the temple. And in fact, the way it worked was, Yehuda had the outer portion of the temple, but the Holy of Holies was actually located in the tribe of Binyamin, and this was prophesied in Moshe Rabbeinu's farewell blessing to Binyamin. If you look in Zot HaBracha, we read on Simchat Torah, so Moshe and Binyamin, Yedid Hashem, you are the beloved of God. Chofef alav kol hayam, the divine presence hovers over you every day. Ubein ketefav shachem, and God dwells between your shoulders. There's even a reference to that in a second, which means to say the Shekhinah, which is in the Kodesh HaKadoshim of all places, that is in the Chelek of Binyamin. And even Ben Ketefav Shechem, between the shoulders, Chazal have a very interesting comment. The Har HaBayit is not the highest mountain in Jerusalem. You have Har HaTzofim, you have other areas that are higher. And yet, God decreed that the temple should not... It's similar to the Midrash on Mount Sinai. Remember, the tall mountains wanted the Torah to be given. And God said, I will go to the lower mountain. Even in Jerusalem, God chooses somewhat of a lower mountain for the Beit HaMikdash as a symbol of humility. But Chazal see this in Moshe's blessing. Because if you look at your shoulders, you know, where the neck joins, there's an indentation. The part of the collar is slightly below the shoulders. Like the shoulders are higher than the collarbone. And since it describes that God dwells between Binyamin's shoulders, that suggests that the Makom HaMikdash will be lower than some of the areas surrounding it. So this was seen to be in Moshe Rabbeinu's blessing. So the truth is, the Beit HaMikdash is actually split. Now, there's another discussion in the Talmud, however, to the following effect. And that is, Yerushalayim as a city was in the Chelek of Yehuda. And the temple was split between Yehuda and Binyamin. Of course, it's a very beautiful connection, because as you know, Yehuda, the great son of Leah, was willing to give his life to save Binyamin. And that's reminiscent of another story. If you remember, there's a story, now this is interesting, many people consider this their favorite midrash, although some say it's a non-Jewish folktale that does not have a makor in Chazal. But it's an amazing thing. But this is the famous story about the two brothers. The idea was, why was the temple built there? Because there were two brothers. One brother had no children and had a lot of grain, etc. And basically, one brother was willing to share, kind of an O. Henry story. beautiful story, and it shows you, in other words, that the site of the temple was a place where there was brotherhood and unity and love for each other, which fits very beautifully the statement of Chazal that it straddles the boundary of Yehuda and Binyamin. Because remember how Yehuda was willing, remember Yosef, when they found the silver cup in Binyamin's bag? And Binyamin was going to be taken as a slave. He came forward and said, take me instead. It's also a sign of that love and that sacrifice. However, I checked, if you looked at, you've seen Legends of the Jews by Lewis Ginsberg, which is a very, very detailed compendium of Midrashim with all sorts of sources. He gives the source for everything. And he recounts this story, but in the footnote, he says that he was not able to find a Jewish origin, and he actually referred it to a Germanic source of fairy tale or whatever it is. So it may, again, I can't say for sure, but my basic feeling is if he couldn't find it, I cannot find it. I mean, he spent 30 years on this. So it's interesting that this beautiful thought, which is often said as a midrash, actually does not have a clear source in Chazal. On the other hand, it is so consistent with the Yehuda and Binyamin idea that it almost appears that it ought to be the case. But one other thing, though. The Talmud has another discussion that although Yerushalayim was located within Yehuda's chelek, it did not belong to the tribe of Yehuda. It belonged to all of the Jewish people. So it's an interesting idea, similar to Washington, D.C., Lahavdil.
Yeah.
Washington, D.C. is located on land that was taken from Maryland and partially from Virginia. But it is not part of Maryland. It belongs, well, actually, it's a separate city, but at least we look at it emotionally as if it belongs to the people of the United States. And Yerushalayim, in that sense, was said not to belong to any tribe, but it belonged to all of Klal Yisrael. Now, the Gemara has an implication for that. Listen to what the Gemara says. The Gemara says, since Yerushalayim belonged to all of the Jewish people, then when Jews came up to Yerushalayim for the three pilgrimage festivals, they could not be charged rent for hotel rooms or whatever it is, because the city belonged to them. Now, the Gemara does say you could be charged for ancillary services. So, for example, if I gave you a bed, I could charge you for the bed. But I couldn't charge you for the space. The space belonged to you. So if you were willing to sleep outside, you could not be charged rent for, even if you slept in my backyard or whatever, because it belonged to every single Jew.
Yeah. I remember in all the Triolegolim, they went up, nobody was without a sleeping place.
That's correct.
Maybe it's
I'll tell you, it's an interesting interpretation. Pirkei Avot enumerates a number of miracles that occurred during the time of the Beit HaMikdash. And one of the miracles is, no person ever said, it is too crowded for me in Yerushalayim. But you can interpret that two ways. Mm-hmm. Was the miracle that everybody had room? Or was the miracle that nobody could, even if they did? You could interpret it that the bigger miracle was not that there was room. The bigger miracle is that people were happy. They did not complain about it. So there are two interpretations. Which is the bigger miracle?
Yeah.
Yes. With the story of Yonah, yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
Or
Shaul. Right.
And we assume that
his will is. In fact, the Gemara says like this. The Gemara actually says that the Chalukat Ha'aretz, the division of the land, was effected both by Goral and by Urim Betumim, right? The Kohen Gadol wears the breastplate. Mm-hmm. And through the lights, you know how the Urim Tumim, you have the jewels for each tribe, and on each jewel is the name of the tribe, Reuven, Shimon, and through letters lighting up, you could actually spell out words. Yeah, basically it was an idea of multiple confirmation, basically. The Goral was not exclusive. The Goral and the Urim Tumim, basically if God is showing you over and over again, that judgment, we have recount after recount, etc. It shows, and you get the same answer right here. Every time you do it, you get a different answer. But if you get the same answer and over again, that lends a certain... Because you have to understand, Chalukat Ha'aretz is a very controversial proposition. Who gets what? It's a major, major issue. And therefore, Yeshua wanted to repeat it in many, many ways, in different ways, so that people would have a sense of its divine validity. Because remember, God is not speaking. This is not like the Ten Commandments, where God is speaking to all of the Jewish people. Rather, the leaders are saying, this is what God told us. So the people might be a little suspicious, and therefore they need to have these spiritual messages with the participation of all of the heads of the tribes, so that nobody will question it. But indeed, there was the Goral and there was the Urim, the two men.
I was happy, yeah. So they take a course with the Rabbi, or whatever his name is, Sally's word, and he mentioned Urim to me as magic. I don't like it.
Well, you know, I don't know what the orientation was. I mean, Urim and Thummim is the motto of Yale University. How could that be? How could that be magic?
Okay.
It's
on the motto.
Yeah, that's the thing. That's what I'm saying. Urim and Thummim, once again, is a form of prophecy. That's all. In other words, when there was prophecy, one of the specific forms of prophecy was consulting the Urim and Thummim, which would give prophecy. God would give the prophecy via lighting up of the letters. But the thing was this. The thing was, this is where it gets tricky. Ramban explains, when the letters lit up, they were not seen by everybody. Rather, the Kohen Gadol had a prophetic vision of letters. So consequently, you'd be looking at it, you wouldn't see anything. That's why you need the Goral to confirm the prophecy. Otherwise, you could make up. I'm sorry, did you want to say?
I just wanted to ask, today we can live wherever we want. And while you said that if a fisherman wanted to move in those days, it was like perhaps an individual, not a tribal.
That's thing. Correct.
Didn't the division of the land, in a way, dictate what the citizenry would do for a living, like the fishermen on the coastal and the
men
in the south
I think that's correct. I think that's correct, and we have to assume that to the extent that this was bahashgacha, we have to assume that, you know, God's judgment is what people are best suited for. Now, that's not to say, you know, if you lived in the north, you had to be a fisherman. There was migration. There was the ability of leaving your territory. But overall, there was a sense that tribes had certain missions and certain functions which could best be performed where they were. And then, of course, there are certain jobs that you need everywhere, right? Everywhere you need lawyers, right? You need doctors. I don't know if you need lawyers. I mean, the point is that there were certain jobs that transcended, you know, the geography of the place in which...
What about marriage? Yeah. When somebody married another tribe. Where did it pop
up? Okay, so here it would depend. See, again, it gets complicated because if you remember, in the Torah itself, when the daughters of Tzelafchad, who are from the tribe of Menasheh, their uncles, their father's brothers, expressed concern that if these women marry men from other tribes and have children, when they die, their inheritance is going to go to their children, who, of course, under patrilineal lineage, are now members of the other tribes. And the Torah says that they have to marry within their family. But that was a temporary point. Eventually, we will see. And that's another reason why the tribal system fell into misuse. Because eventually, there was free, I'll say inter, not intermarriage, but in a way it's intermarriage for this purpose, free intermarriage between the tribes. And when you have free intermarriage between the tribes, you will eventually, over the course of time, have many people who have halachically belonged to another tribe, who are the owners of lands in another section. So, in the course of time, it'd be interesting to see the survey data on this. In the course of time, the territory of Yehuda could have been largely, I don't know largely, but a large proportion could have been Yisachar, Zebulun. Right? So it was not fixed. And that wouldn't go back in Yovel, because that's regular inheritance. I mean, that's going to remain. If I inherit from my mother property, that remains my property. That doesn't go back in Yovel or anything else, because I am considered to be the owner. If I sell property, you know, Yovel, it goes back. So it's a very good point. That is another reason why the tribal system could not really be maintained indefinitely. It was really an initial thing, and then it gets diluted and changed by that. Yeah.
So that you can't determine which they said that only a few tribes survived when there was the dispersion.
Well, yeah. Well, our big problem is what happened to the 10 tribes? That's really the big issue. We know the 10 tribes were exiled by Sancheirib, the king of Assyria, around 130 years before the destruction of the temple. The northern kingdom was destroyed, and therefore at the time of the Babylonian exile, you only had the south, Yehuda, Binyamin and Leviim, who are still around. Now the question becomes, though, does that mean, we talk about the lost 10 tribes, does that mean every single Jew, every one of us, must either be Binyamin, Yehuda, or Kohen or Levi? Not necessarily, because the reason is, number one, as I indicated, because of inheritance and the like, even within the southern kingdom, there may have been many people from other tribes. There's also migration. So consequently, although the northern kingdom was destroyed, there were many individuals and families from all the tribes that did migrate to the south. And therefore, any one of us could be any tribe at all. In other words, it's contrary to the popular assumption that we must be of the two tribes of the south. That's not true. You could be a Gad or a Reuven or a Menasheh because of the inheritance issue and because of the migration. There's also a whole discussion. There are some opinions in the Talmud that even say the 10 tribes came back. And, you know, as you know, there's a whole big discussion during the Middle Ages. Some say the Ethiopian Jews are descended from, in fact, that's what they say. Their claim is they are descended from the tribe of Dan. Right? That is their claim. And there are other, and during the Middle Ages, people were coming from China and other countries claiming to be descendants of Jews. In the 19th century, there was a widespread theory that American Indians, Native Americans, were the remnants of the 10 tribes. Some say the Vikings, right? So there's all sorts of something will have to, like Elvis, you know, Elvis pops around everywhere. So somebody is saying the 10 tribes are popping around all over the place. So we don't know. But the point I want to say is, though, that any one of us could be from the 10 tribes because there was a migration to the south. Yeah.
Also, yeah. Wasn't there a high amount of conversion during the Roman Empire?
In other words, non-Jews converted.
That's
very interesting. You know, it is interesting that although we normally say Jews, we're not into proselytization, which is true, some have suggested that there was a time historically when we were into proselytization. It's not entirely, I don't know if we were into it, but at least we had many, many converts. It is estimated that at the height of the Roman Empire, over 20% of the Roman Empire were Jews, which is a staggering, staggering number, and that was primarily through conversion. Now, why Judaism would have been attractive during Roman times? Well, I guess that shows you it must have been the religion, because there was certainly no extraneous reason. I mean, it's like becoming Jewish during the Holocaust. Like, you know, who's going to become Jewish? Although I am aware, it's interesting what a tzaddik a person might be to convert to Judaism during the Holocaust in Nazi-occupied Europe. There were a few that did. There were a few that did. And that really shows you what a sincere ger is. In fact, the Gemara says that the test of real sincerity is when one becomes Jewish at a time when Jews are persecuted and afflicted. But yes, there were many, many converts during the Roman Empire.
Paul in the New Testament says, those Jews will go to the end of the world to proselyte. It was later on that the popes said you cannot on your death.
That's why we
stopped proselyting.
That might be true. In other words, one might connect the idea of not proselytizing to the fact that it was a capital crime to do so.
The rabbi was a wonderful man when Wilmington, North Carolina, came up and wanted to proselytize. He was such a good man, and my husband sent him away, and I felt so bad. I ran down the steps.
Yeah.
He said, go to rabbi in some other place.
Yeah.
And then I knew that he does proselytize.
Well, you know, I get this newsletter. Maybe you see it's this national conference to increase Jews or something. It's an organization in Silver Spring. I don't know who the person is. Where of course, the Reform Movement too is pushing it. The notion of proselytizing Jews. Again, it's not something that, in the halachic tradition, would be pursued seriously. The only proselytization that we are encouraged to do, which we don't do that much, is to encourage the non-Jewish world to keep the seven Noahide laws. There is a mitzvah to proselytize for the Noahide commandments, although, as far as I know, nobody's doing that. I mean, there's a Noahide movement, but I don't see that many Jewish organizations involved in that. But there is no mitzvah. Again, I mean, one of the unique ideas of Judaism is that for non-Jews, Judaism is not the exclusive way of salvation. I mean, and that's almost unique, because virtually every other religion preaches to the world at large, you can achieve salvation only through following our way. And we do not say that. We say you.
All the righteous have a...
Right. You can achieve salvation in following your way. It doesn't have to be our way. If you want to embrace our way, you will be welcomed and given an honored place. Right? The Mashiach comes from a Jew by choice, right? David comes from Rut, the Moabite. And yet, it's very, very important that Judaism does not say you have to be us to be close to God. So in a sense, the proselytization thing is a step backwards, because it's almost like saying, yeah, you got to be us, or you ought to be us, which is really against against our tradition. I mean, you know, it's kind of, okay, I don't want to get political, but I mean, it's a wrong solution for a real problem. The real problem is the vanishing Jewish population. You're losing Jews by intermarriage, you're losing Jews by assimilation, you're losing Jews by ignorance. So you want to augment, you want to solve that problem by making non-Jews Jewish. But, you know, I would say you solve that problem by keeping Jews Jewish instead of making non-Jews. I mean, you know, you could declare, let's make China Jewish, you know, and you'll automatically gain, you know, 2 billion Jews. But, you know, if they're not committed, it's not worth that much. Yeah.
I'm just going to say that I think maybe the use of the word proselytize, I think, may be than what a lot of the theory is. I think the theory is to have a more open attitude towards many potential converts rather than have keeping them in a very hostile way. So I'm not so sure that it is necessarily, you know,
Well, listen, certainly the notion that one who chooses to be Jewish out of their own inner conviction should be welcomed and respected and made a full part of the community is something that is stated over and over again. The Talmud says that the Torah repeats 36 times how the ger must be treated with respect and dignity.
It's greater than Moses, isn't it? Doesn't it say in Talmud that it's greater
I don't remember that statement, but you might be right. But certainly there are many, many statements about how the converts must be treated with the utmost respect and dignity. In fact, it's interesting, though. You do find how the same passage could be interpreted positively and negatively. There's a statement in the Talmud, and again, it sounds very harsh, so I apologize if initially it's harsh, but I'll give you the interpretation right afterwards. It says, converts, Jews who convert, gerim, are as difficult for the Jewish people as a plague of leprosy. Now, this is a statement. Now, there are two interpretations that are offered. One interpretation is, because many converts, not all of course, many converts were ignorant, they didn't have the background, so they were ignorant of how to live a fully Jewish life, and as a result they created difficulties. But there's an interpretation that is quoted in the name of Rabbi Avraham the convert, who says that the gerim are bad for us as leprosy because they make us look bad because of their devotion and their commitment.
meaning they are
a reproach. Because the truth of the matter is, a person who's born Jewish might sometimes have to ask themselves a very embarrassing question. That is, if I had the choice, would I have made this choice? Sometimes a person's answer might be, you know, it would be easier not to make that choice. And when someone makes that choice, that's something very deeply to be admired. You know, there's a story. In the time of the Vilna Gaon, a beautiful story. Again, this is a total digression, but it's such a beautiful story I just want to share with you. There was, in Lithuania, at that time, it was really a capital offense to convert to Judaism. Yeah. There were times in Europe where you could be burnt. And there was Count Potocki. Potocki was a member of the Russian nobility who converted to Judaism in the time of the Vilna Gaon. And he was a Ger Tzedek. He's called the Righteous Convert of Vilna. In fact, he's buried right next to the Vilna Gaon. He's given a supreme honor of being buried right there. And the story goes, he was burnt at the stake the second day of Shavuot. They actually burnt him on the holiday of Matan Torah. And the story goes that the night before he was to be executed or burnt, the Vilna Gaon paid him a visit. And he found that the count was crying, was sobbing. And the Vilna Gaon tried to comfort him, saying, why are you sobbing? You know, you're dying to sanctify God's name, and there's no mitzvah greater, and the Olam Haba will be so great, and you're not, and there's even a tradition that one who dies al Kiddush Hashem does not feel pain at the moment of death. So the count said, I'm not crying because of that. I'm very happy to give my life for God, but I'm crying because I never had a chance to marry as a Jew. I never had children. I don't have a family, and I'm so upset. I'm going to go to Olam Haba, and there's nobody that's going to be with me. I'm going to be all alone in Olam Haba. So the Vilna Gaon quoted a midrash. The midrash says there's a verse in Yeshayahu where God says, "Ani Rishon, I am the first, v'ani acharon, and I am the last." This is a pasuk. So the midrash comments, "Ani Rishon, I am the first, l'mi she'ein lo av, for someone who doesn't have a father, I am their father. I am the." And v'ani acharon, and I am the last, meaning l'mi she'ein lo ben, for someone who does not have a son, I am the son. Whatever that means exactly, but God says, I will be your child and I will be your father. Now, it's interesting that there is another girsa in that midrash, which really makes it a polemic against Christianity. In other words, one midrash says, Ani Rishon, I am the first, She'ein Li Av. God says, I don't have a father. I am the last, She'ein Li Ben. I don't have a son. Meaning there's no father and there's no son here. According to that girsa, which I think is the standard girsa that we have in our midrash, it is actually an anti-Trinity statement.
Sure. Yeah.
But the Vilna Gaon changed the word li to lo. L'mi she'ein lo av. I am the father for he who does not have a father. I am the son for he who does not have a child. And he told the Ger Tzedek that you will be directly, you know. But be it as it may, I just brought this up to show you, you know, what a righteous convert can be. And there is a tradition too. I never heard the song, but there's a tradition that there was a nigun, a certain tune that the Ger Tzedek sang as he was being led to his death. And this tune was sung in the Lithuanian yeshivot for over 100 years. This was a well. There are probably people who know it today. I've never heard it, but this is called the nigun of the Ger Tzedek of Vilna. In other words, God is called the
Father.
No, but either way.
Somebody's in the Olam Haba, somebody's
yeah.
an orphan,
yeah.
they can't father,
yeah.
and you would hope that father would be in the Olam Haba.
Well, I don't know the biographical details of his relationship to his parents. I mean, if his parents rejected him, disinherited him, didn't want anything to do with him, presumably they're not going to be in Olam Haba together either. I mean, they cut him off. I believe the story was they turned him in. I'm not sure, but I believe that might have been the story, because he was of the landowning, he was the nobility, and
right. No, I understand, yeah. but it's still.
No, but you see, it's not just Olam Haba. It's also a message in this world that a person who feels bereft and cut off and lonely should find a solace with Hashem's presence.
Mm-hmm.
That a person is never really alone in that sense. There's HaKadosh Baruch Hu.
Yeah.
No, but he was giving, but the point is that you see how one letter can make a totally ain li ain lo. There are two girsot in the midrash.
We are very fortunate to in this room to have a convert.
Well,
no,
okay.
No, I really mean it.
Well, listen, we don't have to, Baruch Hashem, you know, that's wonderful. We don't have to point out, we don't have to point out people's individual personal lives. Again,
I think she's very tough.
Well, you have to, yeah. Listen, it's, again, the issue is this. The issue is like everything else. Everything is true, meaning to say, just as there are Jews who sometimes bring discredit on Judaism, and there are Jews who are magnificent representatives of what it means to be Jewish. In the world of Jews by choice, we have the same thing, but perhaps less so. We sometimes have Jews that might bring discredit, but the overwhelming majority bring a tremendous amount of credit to the Jewish nation. As I say, anybody that claims Judaism as a system is rejecting of converts, is forgetting the fact that Mashiach comes from Rus the Moabite. I mean, we can never forget that as such a glorious statement that he sincerely embraces the religion of God will be entitled to the greatest honors. Yeah.
I have to say that when I hear about the comparison of leprosy, that the way we look at
yeah.
the situation of conversion,
right.
and and the fact that being righteous towards a convert appears so many times
yes.
in text, I'm wondering if it's really understanding that we who are not converted Jews often are not as compassionate and loving in the real world towards converts as we should be and as we must be.
Well, you know, Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel once said that the biggest mistake we make is to judge Judaism by the behavior of Jews. Meaning to say, yeah, obviously, we fail in hundreds and hundreds of ways every day. But that's not an indictment of the system. That's an indictment of our imperfections in carrying out what Jewish values are. And you're right. So should we raise consciousness? Should we, emphasize? Of course, obviously, yes. The story I remember reading with the Chazon Ish, she was a very, you would call him an extreme right-wing rabbi in Bnei Brak, but a very, very great, great posek. He died in the 1950s, and basically was very, very, and he had a very strict halachic interpretation. And he, on Simchat Torah, he bumped into a ger who had moved to Bnei Brak. Now, Bnei Brak, you would think, is not an environment where there are that many gerim hang around Bnei Brak. That's not where they would gravitate normally. And he noticed that the person was not into the festivities of the day. So the Chazon Ish, who was in his 70s, began to sing and dance in front of him in the middle of the street to cheer him up. This is what that was. So it's an important, very, very important thing. Yeah.
Get back to the Jewish God.
Yeah.
Before
you
can.
I pointed it.
Yes.
Is it true that in the north, that some Jews remained in Israel, in the land, and only when the Babylonians took over the south and dispersed and that everybody went? This is what I heard. And does this mean that, when they say the 10 lost tribes, they don't actually mean, lost a huge amount of people lost, but maybe it just means the delineations were lost?
Yeah, the lost 10 tribes really means, you're correct, the destruction of the northern kingdom. It was the dissolution of a state. Given individuals, as I say, there were many individuals who migrated to the south. There may have been some pockets in the north, right? Just like after World War II, you had these Japanese soldiers that, remember, I still remember, they're probably all gone now.
Right.
I still remember in the 1970s, they would find, some Japanese soldier that was still, he never got the order to surrender. So there was, can be a very isolated area. There's all sorts of caves and places you could hide. So certainly there were pockets. That's why I'm saying that the Lost Ten Tribes does not make the claim that this population just vanished from the face of the earth. It does mean that their kingdom was destroyed and was never reestablished.
And they were resettled, weren't they?
Well, resettled by?
By the conqueror, by
Sancheriv. Well, Sancheriv moved them. Sancheriv moved them to other countries. And there they got assimilated or lost. They were not killed. They were not massacred. But Sancheriv had a policy that was common in the ancient world of transplanting populations. Because that kind of disoriented you. So if you're used to a hot climate, he would move you to Alaska, etc., things like that. And the 10 tribes were relocated to different parts of Asia. And that's how the Samaritans got to the land of Israel. He brought in the so-called, they're called Samaritans because they settled in Samaria, but he brought populations from Asia and he settled them into the land of Israel.
Didn't
Yosef which one? Yosef did a similar idea of taking the farmers and bringing them to the cities. Yeah.
Reason that they disappeared, after two tribes, Judah and Ben, they made for 2,000 years and they're still here.
Well, if you remember,
why did they disappear?
On the ninth of Av, we recite keynotes, and if you're a very close observer of keynotes, there's keynotes the night of Tisha B'Av, and there's keynote in the morning of Tisha B'Av, and they're different. Now, at night we only say a few, but there's only one keynah that is recited both in the evening and at the night. It's actually the very last one, and this was authored by Shlomo Ibn Gabarel, who was the famous Spanish poet of the 10th century, who wrote Adon Olam, among other things. But he was also a very, very great philosopher, a very, very well-known philosopher. And this is a poetic debate between the kingdom of the 10 tribes and the southern kingdom as to who suffered worse. Meaning, The kingdom of the ten tribes said, though I suffered because I never came back. And you at least got a second chance. And the seven kingdom says, I was exiled twice and you were only exiled once. So they're debating, like, who has it worse? So, indeed, the point was that the ten tribes, the truth is, because they broke away. They broke away from the Beit HaMikdash. Essentially, one could even look at it this way. In the north, Judaism was a matter of nationalism. And in the south, it was more of a matter of religious consciousness. And I think that also has an important lesson, meaning a Jewish identity that is predicated on political structure alone is not going to be an enduring Judaism. In the south, you had the Beit HaMikdash, you had the Torah, you had a different way of identifying that person. Because if your identity is bound up with nationality, then you're not given the resources to survive in Galut. Because once you've lost your country, what's going to keep you going? If your Judaism is connected to Torah, then you have a mechanism. But again, this is hard to say. I mean, God forbid this should ever happen. But the one thing we do know is that the Jewish people can survive a Galut even without the land of Israel. Again, God forbid that should ever happen. But we know that we could survive because we did survive. I mean, that itself is the biggest proof that the Jewish people can survive, attenuated, crippled perhaps, very diminished, but the Jewish people can survive because our bond to Hashem and to each other is one that can transcend even having our own national land. So the problem of the Northern Kingdom could very well be that their identity was bound up in a territory, perhaps in a greater sense than the Southern Kingdom, which had the Beit HaMikdash, the spiritual ideas of Judaism. Yes?
Friend, you hear comments, we don't want peace in Israel, but you hear some commentaries of some American Jews' identity just being with Israel being threatened.
Yeah.
That threat disappear and they don't have a religion as an identification, that it will even further.
Well, it's very true. It happens to be that often it is only crisis that gives people a sense. It's been well said that if anti-Semitism were to disappear from the world tomorrow, we would lose a lot of Jews because a lot of people identify because of the enemy they have to fight. That's unfortunate. That's unfortunate because it's not enough to know who you are against. You have to know what you are for. That's why very often if Jews who might be relatively indifferent to Jewish activities, if there's a demonstration against Louis Farrakhan or whatever it is, they will come out in large numbers to engage in the debate. But as I say, that's not a permanent way of building Jewish identity. Because after a while it backfires. Even the Holocaust, which has been a major, major experience that people identify as with the Jewish destiny, eventually backfires because when you portray Jewish identity as a matter of being victimized and being excluded, at some point there is an impatience. People say, well, why do I have to identify myself as a victim all the time? And that's why you find, God forbid, the very, very distressing phenomenon of some Jewish kids as kind of not being interested in the Holocaust experience, because they say, isn't there more to Judaism than just, we always get persecuted? So that's why you have to build Judaism on a positive basis and not just talking about that. But you are correct. I mean, certainly what we do see in the world is that it is the victimization of Jews, often put Jews together, which is a good thing, but it's not enough. You have to have something more than that. Yeah.
But living in the Northern Kingdom was not voluntary. This was Goro. This is how Hashem put them there without a base on Mikdash.
No, but wait one second. God's plan in the book of Yoshua was not to have a divided kingdom. It was supposed to be one unified Malchut. In fact, there wasn't even a kingdom then.
But
so,
even being so far away.
Well, okay, but the point was there were the three pilgrimage festivals. The division of the kingdom later was through Yerevan ben Nevat. That was not God's original. I mean, God knew, of course, but that was not God's plan. So I'm not suggesting just because you're living up north that severs you from religion. What I'm saying is it is the division of the kingdom that created this machloket. That happened much later. Okay. How do we get on to some of this? I don't recall at all, but...
Before
we
go back to topic,
so
I'll have one last one off the topic.
Yeah.
Something is acquired by purchase, the Cave of Machpelah or
yes.
the Temple Mount. Is it lost through conquest? It needs to be repurchased, or does the is because it was by sale? Does that
give it more of a permanent...
Yeah, that's a very, very interesting halachic question. Again, just to reiterate, it is interesting that there are three portions of the land of Israel that we acquired by purchase and not by conquest. One is the Temple Mount. The other is the Cave of Machpelah in Hebron. Abraham bought it. And the third is, ironically, the city of Shechem. That's where Yosef's tomb was located, which they just destroyed brick by brick. That is recorded in the Torah that when Yaakov returned after his years of Galut, Yaakov purchased the city of Shechem. Of course, there had been later there would be a lot of problems with that. But the question that was raised is, okay, we purchased it, we didn't conquer it, but then there's conquest and dispossession. Does that terminate our rights as purchaser? It would seem not, because it's ours. Sometimes we don't lose it because somebody steals it from us. So it's very interesting that among the most hotly contested areas is, of course, the Temple Mounts and Hebron, of course, and Shechem. And it's almost as if God said, I want to be sure that you recognize your right to these places, because it's not that you conquered it from them and then they conquered it from you, in which case, you know, you would have no better claim, so to speak, but rather you bought it, and therefore it is actually yours.
He could have gotten it for nothing, too. Abraham.
Abraham
wanted to give it to him. Don't do me favors, I want to buy it.
Yeah, of course, there's all discussion whether that was a sincere offer or whether that was just the beginning of a negotiation. You know, I get filled... the old model for the negotiation techniques.
Well, that's true that these are thinking smart
words. Well, that's right. That was Mark Twain's point. Mark Twain's point is if only you know, a few hundred miles to the south, we get the oil, you know, the treasure. You know, we chose the... But again, the answer basically is, I mean, Eretz Yisrael certainly has, you know, many, many resources on a small scale, but Eretz Yisrael is a spiritual land. So consequently, you can't just say, let's go to Uganda, let's go somewhere else, let's go to the south. The Kedusha is there, and that's what it is.
But at the same time, Israel doesn't have the same policy towards the conquest of Arabs.
Mm-hmm. Well... Yeah, but I think there is a fundamental difference between one who is a victim of a war of aggression and in trying to repel the enemy gains territory, and one that would engage in an aggressive war of conquest. I think there is a difference there. Meaning, if I am attacked and I try to fight back, and as a result I succeed in driving you away, I think the
some people were attacking.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. Again, there are some legal questions, halachic and legal questions, and that is, that's abandonment. Meaning to say, Israel, as far as I know, Israel never had a legal policy that Arabs could not come back and claim ancestral territory. I mean, there's not been an abandonment. Now, legally, if somebody abandons their property, that's called hetzker. If I abandon my property, now, again, the question...
I understand
that. And then you have the problem that more Jews did leave Arab countries. I mean, basically, in the aggregate, the things not only cancel out, but, you know, we're in a net creditor position. Though, in terms of individual rights, you know, it's hard to say. I mean, the Arabs that stayed were allowed to keep their property. So the issue becomes abandonment. I mean, that is an issue of you know, halakha and international law. But the point was that these were defensive wars.
Well, yeah. But how did you finally define the difference halakha
land
that is
purchased? No, the point is this. The point is that land that is when you acquire land by conquest, and then the land is conquered away from you, you have in many ways less of a moral claim to keep that land, because you got it by conquest, right? He who lives by the sword dies by the sword. When you acquire land by purchase, then when the conqueror takes the land away from you, you would have a claim to get it back, unless you abandon it, unless you relinquish it, etc. So God wanted to strengthen our claim to the Temple Mount, and therefore he required it by purchase. Or the other point I made earlier, at least for the Temple Mount, God wanted the Beit HaMikdash to be a place of shalom, but that doesn't explain Chevron. By the way, another irony is Chevron was actually an Ir Miklat. One of the cities of refuge was Chevron. So Chevron, which is the center of so much violence today, was actually a city of refuge. Yeah. Although I have a question with that, because it does say, if you read the chapter, we discover that Chevron, see, we're normally not told which individuals had which property. That would take too long to go through a million. Thank you. Going through millions of individuals. But one of the single case where we're told who got a specific piece of land is, we are told that Kalev ben Yefuneh, Yoshua's good friend, was given Chevron as his own inheritance. And that apparently is a contradiction. Kalev is from the tribe of Yehuda, but Chevron is an Ir Miklat, and the Ir Miklat, we know, were the cities that were given to the Levi'im. So the Gemara says, it doesn't mean Chevron proper, it means the areas around Chevron, because Chevron was actually an Ir Miklat. Yeah.
So the Jubilee year doesn't apply to property that's bought from...
That's correct. And in fact, the Jubilee year doesn't apply today, at least, at all, as you know. Otherwise, we would be having people, imagine if Yovel would start today, things would be awfully complicated. I mean, you have the Tel Aviv beach, which has, millions, billions of dollars of hotels and property, and some guy claimed, well, I can trace my ancestry back to this person from Zvolun that got this property, etc. Give me the hotel. Exactly. It's like the Indians wanting to get Manhattan Island back for $24 of beads. Yeah, so Yovel will be a very difficult problem. As I say, to me, I don't even know how Yovel can be reinstituted, like my question before, if the tribal division is going to be a fundamentally different tribal division when Mashiach comes, based on Yechezkel's prophecy. So, in effect, your ownership is going to be reallocated to a different portion of the land. So that's going to be a big problem. Okay, now let me just mention one other technical problem. And this, again, is a very technical area. Other than Kalev getting Chevron, which is very interesting, Kalev goes to Yoshua and says, I am 85 years old, and you remember the old days when we were spies together, and how I was faithful in keeping God's commandments. And Yoshua gives him Chevron. Now that means, apparently, Chevron was not allocated by lottery. Chevron was just given to him. Why Chevron, of all places? So it's interesting. You can give a very explanation based on the Chumash itself. The Chumash says that when the spies were sent, Vayavo ad Chevron, he came to Chevron. Now it switches from plural to singular. It says, the spies traveled, and he came to Chevron. Who's the he? Rashi explains that Kalev ben Yefuneh made a detour to go to Chevron. He made the detour. Why? Because he knew, he had an intimation that the spies would come back with an evil report and they would say Lashon Hara about the land of Israel. And he wanted to pray by the gravesites of Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Sarah, Rivka, and Leah, Rachel is not buried there, that God should give him the strength to be able to convince the Jewish people not to follow the advice of the spies. So it's Midah Keneged Midah, because he went to Chevron to pray that he should be successful in his mission, which in a sense he was not, because he did not convince them, but he was successful at least that he maintained his own faith. Chevron was given to him as the place. And therefore, that's why it was given to him. If you look, this is already... Yehuda, he was Yehuda. In fact, Chevron is located in the land of Yehuda. It was given to him. If you look in chapter 14, verse 10, which is the middle of his speech, Biata, and now, Kalev is 85 years old. Hine hechiyeh Hashem oti, God has allowed me to live. Kasher di berzeh, as God promised, arba'im v'chamesh shana, 45 years. So he's now 85. Me'az diber Hashem et hadavar hazel Moshe, from the time that he had spoken to Moshe, she'alach yisrael b'midbar, that the Jewish people were in the midbar. V'yata, hine anochi hayom ben chamesh u'shmonim shana. Behold, I am today 85 years old. It seems to be his birthday. Anochi hayom implies, this is my birthday. Odeni hayom chazak. So he's kind of boasting a little bit. I am still strong as I was then. But keep in mind that the idea of chazak is not necessarily physical strength, but it's also moral courage. Meaning, 40 years ago, I had faith that Hashem will give us this land. And now, we conquered a lot of it. Even though there is much more to conquer, I still have that faith, and my faith has been confirmed. Kekochiyaz, as my strength was then, uchekochiyata, my strength is now. Again, as I say, it could very well be moral strength. Although we will see that apparently he still had some physical vitality in him as well, because he actually engaged in some military conquest of his own. And Tamari Yitzhar Hazeh, give me the mountains, these are the mountains of Hebron, etc. And Yoshua blessed him, and we are told that Hebron belonged to Kalev ben Yefunah Kenizi. I'll discuss what Kenizi means. Ad Hayom Hazeh, because he followed God's words. Now, you'll see though, a very important point. Hebron, it's not that Kalev wants to get retirement here. Kalev actually requested a portion of the south that was not even yet conquered. Hebron was not yet conquered, and he led a group that conquered it. So indeed, he's 85 years old, and he, in other words, it's very interesting. He doesn't ask for that which was already conquered. He asks for a portion that was not conquered. And then it says, V'shem Hebron Lifanim, the original name of Hebron was called Kiryat Arba. Now, as you know, I mean, that's the modern suburb, beautiful suburb next to Hebron, Kiryat Arba, didn't make up that name. The original name of Hebron was Kiryat Arba. Now, Kiryat Arba, the city of Arba. Now, who is Arba? Now, if you read the Pasuk, literally, Arba does not mean four. Arba means a name. Because look what it says. Mm-hmm. The city of Arba, who was the fearsome giant. I remember the concept was in Hebron, you had these. Again, giant doesn't mean, you know, this is not Jack and the Beanstalk necessarily. We're not talking about, 50-foot people. But it means that the nations that inhabited those areas were extremely tall and strong and fearsome and ferocious. And they're described as Anakim. So Arba is this fearsome giant. So that's the Pashut Pshat, right? That is the simple meaning of Arba. But Chazal have a different interpretation. And the modern name follows this interpretation. We're not going to name a city after this giant Arba, who's not around anymore. But Arba refers to the four Zugot, the four pairs who are buried in Hebron. Adam and Chava, Avraham and Sarah, Yitzchak and Rivka, and Yaakov is buried with Leah. Rachel, of course, is buried in Beit Lechem. That's why it's called Kiryat Arba. It's interesting that the Arabs have a tradition, if you ever go into the mosque, that they actually have Yosef buried in Beit HaMikdash. So their tradition is Yosef is buried there. Our tradition is Yosef is buried in Shechem. So Joseph's tomb is where we say it is, actually. So that makes it maybe not that precise site, but in Shechem. Yeah.
What is the basis for saying that Adam Achava is over there?
Yeah, it doesn't. You're correct. It does not say it in the Torah at all. There is no indication where Adam Achava were buried at all. But Chazal say they were the fourth pair, or they were the first pair. That's how you get four pairs. By the way, somebody asked me recently, it's interesting, that how many years were Avraham and Sarah married? See, the other avot we could figure out, because for Yitzchak, we are told Yitzchak was 40 when he married Rivka. And we know that Yitzchak died at 180. So Yitzchak had a long marriage. Yitzchak was married 140. No, I'm sorry. That's not right. One second. No, Rivka died earlier. No, we can't figure out exactly. Rivka died earlier. But Avraham, it is, there's a medrash, it's not in the Chumash, that Avraham got married when he was 25 years old. And Sarah was 15. We know there was a 10-year difference. So that, now Avraham lived for, Sarah lived right until 127. Sarah lived 127. So if she got married at 15, they were married for, what, 112 years. What's the anniversary gift for that? We know, I know that
doesn't come up much
for the 75th anniversary, it's diamond, I believe.
No, diamond is
50. No, gold is 50. Gold is 50. Yeah, diamond is 75. But beyond 75, I'm not sure what you do. But there was a, Baruch Hashem, very, very long marriage. Okay. All right. By the way, there's even a medrash that says that a rabbi once went down to the Marat HaMachpel, all the inner depths, the actual place where Avraham and Sarah were buried. And he was asked to describe what he had seen. And he said he didn't want to describe it. And it turned out the Talmud gives the description that they were embracing, since some of their souls were embracing. And the Maharal gives a metaphorical explanation that basically says that what a person experiences in Olam Haba is the most important aspect of their lives as it was lived in this world. And all of the great accomplishments of the Avot and the Imahot had as their foundation the relationship they had with each other. In other words, sometimes you find that a person who accomplishes much in the outside world does so at the expense of nurturing a connection. And here you see it was the opposite. It was the connection that gave Avraham the ability to do what he did in the world. Okay, but that's Kiryat Arba. Now then the question becomes this though. If Kiryat Arba, if Arba is not a giant, Kiryat Arba means the city of the four, what is the next phrase? Ha'adam ha'gadol va'anakim, the man that is the greatest of the giants. So Chazal say, allegorically, this refers to Avraham Avinu. That one of Avraham Avinu is a man that was the greatest of the giants. Obviously giants does not mean, in that case, physically tall, but spiritual stature. That the greatest of the spiritual titans was Avraham Avinu. And he's the Adam HaGadol Banakim. Now, then, okay, what time is it now?
11:10.
Okay, just a few more minutes. Now then, however, there's a part two of the colored story. I'm skipping around a little bit because I just want to finish the part of the story. And that is, if you look at chapter 15, verse 13, right? So in chapter 14, Hashem gives, or Yahushua gives Kalev Chevron. But in chapter 15 we read that Hebron was not conquered yet. That Kalev ben Yefuneh got his share, he got Kiryat Arba, and here it says the father of the giant, so that seems to indicate Arba is this giant. And Kalev, not by himself we assume, but with some group of army, conquered or dispossessed the three children of this giant, Sheshai, Achiman, and Talmai, so he conquered it. And then he moved to Devir, which is north of Hebron, and Devir also had a name which was called Kiryat Sefer, the city of the book. Very unusual. That's an unusual name for a Canaanite city. One would not assume that the Canaanites were big in literacy and study. That was not their thing. And I'll come back to this. But it says, the name was Kiryat Sefer, and then Kalev, I guess he's tired after Hebron, he's 85 years old, he says, he who will conquer Kiryat Sefer, I will give Achsa, my daughter, as a wife. So first of all, there's a question here. Who is Kalev to give the orders? I mean, Kalev was given Hebron. He was not given some other city. So if anyone could make this deal, maybe Yahushua could make this deal. What is Kalev's jurisdiction to say, he who conquers this? So apparently, Devir must have been one of the suburbs of Hebron that were given to Kalev. So, who conquered Devir for him? A fellow, Otniel ben Kenaz. But then it says, the brother of Kalev. Well, if you take brother literally, that would mean that Otniel married his niece. Halachically, that's okay. Halacha does permit a person to marry his niece, even though secular law might consider it incestuous. That's the problem. Because Kalev's father is Yefuneh. And Othniel's father is said to be Kenaz. But do you remember? Kalev was also described as Kalev ben Yefuneh HaKenizi from Kenaz. So who is this Kenaz fellow that Kalev seems to be connected to? So the Gemara says that the family relationship was that Othniel and Kalev were half-brothers who shared a mother. And when Yefuneh died, Kalev's mother married a fellow called Kenaz. And Kalev as a child was raised by Kenaz. And therefore we call him Kalev ben Yefuneh, who was raised in the family of Kenaz. And Othniel ben Kenaz was his, not stepbrother, but his half-brother that shared a mother. That's how the Gemara reconstructs the relationship. But this Othniel is a famous guy in his own right, because in point of fact, when you read the book of Judges, he was the first of the Shoftim after the death of Yehoshua. So Othniel ben Kenaz actually took over the leadership, perhaps this was a foreshadowing of the role that took place. So it's kind of a royal family. He doesn't marry Yehoshua's child, but he marries Kalev, is obviously very high up in the hierarchy, because Kalev and Yehoshua are the two survivors from the spies. Othniel, now Yehoshua didn't have children, that's the interesting point. So in effect, Othniel married, was the closest as was possible in Yehoshua's family, although Kalev and Yehoshua are not related, but they're obviously very well connected. Yeah.
If they're talking about giants in this area and the spies,
Maybe
that wasn't, total lie that they just made up.
No, actually, I'll tell you the truth. The truth of the matter is, Chazal never accused the spies of lying. It's important to know that. Everything the spies said were true. They were condemned because they undermined the faith of the people that Hashem would help them. Very, very different. You're making an excellent point. There were giants. Everything they said, in fact, they mentioned these same people that Kalev killed. It's in the Torah. Achiman, Sheshai, Talmai. These are the people that Kalev vanquished. You see? But the story goes, Othniel conquered this Kiryat Sefer, and then he married Kalev's daughter, Achsa. By the way, the Gemara is a cute comment. Why is she called Achsa? If you look at Achsa, Achsa contains within it the letters for angry. Chaf, Ayin, Samach. Here it's Ayin. And it says, Achsa was so beautiful that anybody that set eyes upon her got angry at his wife, kind of thing. Gee, why am I stuck with that? Whatever it would be.
Well.
But we do see that she asked her father, now that her husband conquered Devir, that her father should allocate from Chevron a very nice field for the family. And she says, give me a bracha, give me blessed land, because you have given me desert lands. And she says, give me springs of water. And it says that Kalev gave his daughter gulot iliot, upper springs and lower springs. Kind of a strange bit of a story. In fact, she initially asked her husband, and her husband didn't want to help her out, so she rode, and so she fell off a donkey. It's not clear that, so she seems to have fallen off a donkey, and her husband says, her father says, what's the matter? And she says, I can't take this desert land. Well,
how
yeah.
How old was he?
I don't know his age, but obviously he survived Yehoshua, so he
would become a judge.
Yeah. So here is the thing: this story about Achsa and conquering Kiryat Sefer, and she's demanding wells of water. What is going on here? So the Talmud gives a whole allegorical interpretation, which looks at this story in a midrashic, totally different story, and they basically say that when Moshe Rabbeinu died, there were 3,000 laws, halachot, that were forgotten. Why? It is said that when, before Moshe died, he asked his disciple Yehoshua, is there anything in the Torah that you want me to go over with you, to review with you, to teach you again? And Yehoshua said, you know, I was with you all the time, there's nothing you need to teach me. And Moshe died. And it was said, because of that unwillingness to review with Moshe Rabbeinu, Yehoshua forgot a number of halachot. And the people wanted to stone him, because they said, you don't know the Torah, how can you be our leader? And it is said, when it says, Othniel ben Kenaz, conquered the Vir that was called Kiryat Sefer. Allegorically, it refers to the fact that with his logic and with his understanding of Torah, he was able to restore the lost halachot that were forgotten. And that's Merumaz in the name. Because Devir is a term that appears in the Book of Kings as a reference to the Holy of Holies. And Kiryat Sefer is the city of the book. So the concept is, he restored the Torah of God as it was in the Holy of Holies. And Kiryat Sefer, he restored the laws, the book that was forgotten. And that was the conquest of Kiryat Sefer. And when it says the daughter asked for water, very, very different story. The daughter is basically saying, you know, Torah is called water. She is asking Kalev for a bracha that may our descendants always have the water of Torah. Meaning, it shouldn't dry up, just with my husband. But she wanted a bracha that it should continue. So again, this is obviously taking the whole paragraph out of its context. But it's a very beautiful supplementary message that what is going on here is not the conquest of territory, but what is going on here is the restoration of forgotten Torah and the request that there ought to be a continuation of Torah in their lives forever. And the upper water and the lower water refers to different levels of Torah. The upper water is the part of the Torah that concentrates on understanding divinity. You might call it Kabbalah or mysticism or whatever it might be. And the lower water is the application of the divine truth to the mundane details of everyday life, how to apply it in everyday life. And this is the bracha that she asked. And this, of course, is the bracha that, you know, there's a beautiful prayer that many women recite when they light the Shabbat candles. It's an old tradition. Because the Gemara says, one who lights candles properly will merit to have children who are lovers of God's Torah, because the Torah is compared to light. So there is a prayer of Shabbat candles in which one prays for their children that they should have the light of the Torah. And here you have an example of the woman praying for her children that they should have the upper waters and the lower waters. The only thing that's not totally explained to me is, I'm not sure how Kalev fits into this understanding of the story, because the problem was Yoshua forgot things, but Neil ben Kenaz revived it, so it's not clear exactly what Kalev is doing and why Kalev is instrumental. Who married him? Well, we know, I don't know, we know Kalev married Miriam, but I'm not sure if Achsa, that was his second marriage, I'm not sure if Achsa is a daughter from Miriam or not. Now, Miriam is not alive, Miriam died in the desert. Actually, his second wife is even more interesting. The second wife, he said, was a very old woman. This was Batya, the daughter of Parah. She actually entered, the one who saved Moshe, she actually entered the land of Israel. So he liked older women, because Miriam was much older than him, mm-hmm. and Batya was certainly much older than him. But I don't know whose mother, who was Achsa's mother.
Is Kiryat Sefer the same one that it is today?
No, I don't think it could be. Kiryat Sefer is north of Yerushalayim, is that correct? Yeah, obviously, the way it's described here, Kiryat Sefer must be a suburb of Hebron. So it would be a little bit to the south, yeah.
Well,
but
Santino said that Sefer was really a Canaanite. And it just sounded like Sefer.
Right, okay, yeah, I understand. In other words, that wouldn't have been the case. Right, okay. Although, well, the problem is with Kiryat Arba. In other words, when it says the original name of Ken was Kiryat Arba, was that if Arba meant the giant, that was the Canaanite name. If Arba meant the Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, presumably that would have been a Jewish name. That would not have been... and in fact, the Torah itself says, right, when Sarah dies next week, it says, the Tamad Sarah, the Kiryat Arba, he Chevron, right? So the Torah itself says, the city of Kiryat Arba, which is now known as
Hebron.
Okay, we'll stop here. We should continue next week. Have a good week.
But not next week. Next week.
Oh, next week is Thanksgiving. Okay. So enjoy your turkey. Enjoy your.
I got every minute on the stage.